supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will review the rules of superior seed starting, this time around with more of an emphasis on what to feed those baby plants after they get their first true leaves. We'll also talk to our old friend, Dr. Bill Quarles, about a new fruit fly in town that's a big threat to my raspberries, blueberries, and maybe yours as well. We'll tell you what to do to try to keep this little fly at bay. And, of course, we're going to take lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Michelle, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I am just ducky today, Michelle. Thank you for asking. How are you?
Doing great.
And where?
A little chilly.
Where is Michelle doing great and being a little chilly?
A little chilly here in Haines, Alaska.
Haines. Now, is that southeast Alaska? Is that in like the island chain below the mainland?
Yes, we're actually on the mainland, but we're at the top of that section of southeast Alaska.
Okay, so you're above Juneau.
We're north of Juneau, but and we're more like part of Canada than part of Alaska.
I visited southeast Alaska back in the late 90s with my daughter, who was then 8 years old, and we spent a week in Juneau with the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners there. And then we took the ferry of the Alaska Marine Highway back down to Bellingham, Washington. So we got to see a lot of the Inside Passage, and it's just absolutely gorgeous up there. We really enjoyed that trip. So what can we do for Michelle in Haines, Alaska?
Well, being right here on the beach and on the edge of the forest, we have a lot of spruce and hemlock trees, and they kind of filter our light a lot. We try to cut them back in the winter, and I've been listening to your show since 2006, I guess. So I know that you say, you know, don't cut trees unless they're dormant, and we've been having freeze-thaw winters the last couple years, and I need to figure out how to know when the evergreens are dormant so that I can prune them back safely, correctly, for their sake, and so that they don't kind of drip pitch on us.
Right. And I got to tell our listeners who haven't been to this part of the world, everything grows enormous in southeast Alaska. The trees are enormous. The eagles are enormous. The ravens are enormous. The bears are enormous. They grow cabbages the size of a smart car up there. So things grow really big. It's a very lush area. It's not what people who haven't been there think of Alaska. So you're constantly pruning back evergreens near your home just to, like,
yeah,
get some sunlight through and not be depressed all the time?
Well, there's that, yeah, because we have a wind screen of trees between us and the beach that we like to, you know, thin so that we can get some light in the winter especially, but also around my garden, keeping them cut back without actually felling all of them has been an ongoing task. And most winters up until the last couple of years, we've been able to, you know, we've had long freezes where we know, you know, everything's pretty dormant and we get out there and take care of it. But the last couple of years, it's been high 20s to high 30s to low 20s to high 30s.
And you've had the experience, if you prune them during warm weather, that they bleed a lot.
Yes.
This is the same thing we went through in the mid-Atlantic states and on the East Coast in the weeks leading up to Christmas. You know, normally we like to wait till we get a really nice cold snap to prune holly and evergreen to make your own Christmas decorations, and we never got one. So it finally came down to the fact where people were looking at the 10-day forecast and just looking for a good stretch. waiting until the weather had been cold for at least two nights, and then would be cold for at least two nights after that, not worrying so much about the daytime temperatures unless it was really unusual, but just trying to pick a good pocket where you would be in the middle. You know, if you had six warm days and six cool days, 2 days into your cool days is when you would want to do it. And obviously in a situation like yours, less is always more. Do the least amount you have to do at any given time, and you'll be able to keep the plants shaped better that way, and you'll cut your risk of doing it at the wrong time.
Gotcha. So a smaller project. Well, and find a good window.
Yeah, it's so much smarter a lot of times to go out and prune like every other week for 2 months rather than go out and try to do everything at once. You certainly have a better eye for what you're doing. It's like writing. I mean, anybody can sit down and write two pages of material. It's in the coming back to it and getting rid of stuff and looking at it with a different eye that it gets really good. So, you know, if it works out in your life schedule, doing a little bit here and there, taking advantage of every cold stretch, but not trying to get everything done during that one stretch, will probably give you the best long-term results.
Sounds great. We'll work on watching the forecast then. Thanks, Mike.
All right. You take care.
All right. Thank you. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing just excellent today. David, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and I'm doing well in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
What part of Philly?
I live directly across the street from the Art Museum in a high-rise condominium whose windows face north.
Okay.
Also, by the way, that's where the terrace is, on the north side.
Okay. So I'm thinking north. What do you have a view of? Do you have a view of the Schuylkill?
I have a view of a climbing cascade of row homes. But I'm happy. I'm happy, actually.
That's
a studio apartment. One of the things I do is I rescue discarded houseplants. For whatever the reason, when people move from their condominium in this building,
right,
they take their houseplants and they put them in the trash room. And I just think that's an ignominious end for a houseplant. So I feel sorry for it, and I bring it into my apartment, and I care for it. And most of them are happy enough. But one of the things I've been wondering is, because I drink a lot of coffee, by the way, and not instant, can used coffee grounds be used as fertilizer? And are there certain plants for which they should not be used as fertilizer?
Well, let's put it this way. It would be really easy to overdo it. Coffee grounds, first of all, are very rich in nitrogen. Nitrogen is the primary plant food. It is best used in bulk on plants that do not flower. Sweet corn does well with lots of nitrogen.
None of my plants are flowering plants.
Okay.
None of them.
Well, that's good. Coffee grounds are also somewhat acidic. As to exactly how acidic they are, that's a great bone of contention with people. There have been studies showing that the coffee grounds are extremely acidic. There's others showing that we drink most of the acid. But probably the most important thing is that houseplants, especially if they don't go out for the summer, don't need a lot of food. The basic answer is a little bit would go a long way. So what I would do is I would experiment a little. I would add small amounts of coffee grounds to the plants. Now, none in the wintertime. Because the because the plants are really not utilizing. They may be using a lot of water in the winter if there's low humidity in your apartment. But they're not growing very much. Now, do you put them out on the balcony in the summertime?
I do.
Then you can feed them more. I would start feeding them when they go out on the balcony. Don't overdo it. Just give them a little bit of coffee grounds every couple of weeks. And then if you want to be a real mensch, what you can do is, you know, there's a lot of big plantings all around you, all around the art museum and all these fabulous buildings that are there. Mm-hmm. You know, take your coffee grounds and, you know, take them out in like a quart container. And every time you fill up a quart container, just toss those coffee grounds at the base of a different plant and work your way up and down Fairmount Avenue and up and down the River Drive and give everybody out there just a little taste. And don't overdo it with your house plants because, again, especially in the wintertime, house plants don't need to be fed and it can hurt them.
Thank you so much.
All right.
I appreciate it.
Good luck, David.
Have a good day.
You too, sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear on Saturday and Sunday, March 12th and 13th, at the Fredericksburg Spring Home Show at the Expo Center in Fredericksburg, Virginia. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with the new fly in town, secrets of superlative seed starting, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, seed starting time is just around the corner. We'll go over all of the basics, and we'll have a special emphasis on how to properly feed your little baby plants. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guest. Dr. Bill Quarles is the editor of two very important journals, the IPM Practitioner and Common Sense Pest Control. He is head of the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California, and he joins us today to discuss a new pest in town that is terrifying fruit growers. Bill, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you doing, Mike?
I am just fine today, Bill. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, our latest publication is on a fruit fly called a spotted wing Drosophila. And so it's a worldwide pest. And, you know, like most fruit flies lay eggs in damaged fruit or rotting fruit. But this one is a real pest because it lays eggs in tack fruit that is just ready for market. So blackberries, raspberries, blueberries, strawberries are most at risk. But it also attacks cherries and stone fruit and sometimes grapes. And so the damage can be like 20 to 30% of the crop because you can't sell fruit that's got maggots in it.
And unfortunately, over the past couple of years, as this pest has become obvious, that's how people find out. As you say, you don't go out to your garden and see mangled raspberries. Dear friends of mine who are market farmers saw the little creatures in packaged raspberries just as people were approaching their table, and they had to rush to get these infested things off the table. The raspberries had, up until that point, looked perfect.
Yeah, it's hard to see them. If you inspect the fruit very carefully, sometimes you can see like a depression in it, or when it's really far gone, the eggs that are laid cause fungi to attack it, and so it sort of starts to rot. But another way you can see it is if you look very carefully with a magnifying glass, you can see white tubes sticking out from the surface, and these are breathing tubes for the eggs.
Oh, so they send up little periscopes while they're inside.
That's right. You know, when I go to the store now, I actually look at the raspberries and the blackberries very carefully before I buy them.
As if we didn't have enough to feel compulsive about. Bill, this is a relatively new pest, right? When did it start showing up, and where is it originally from?
It's originally from Asia, most likely China. It's on the U.S. mainland. It showed up in California in 2008. And by 2013, it had spread entirely across the country, and it's now found in all the fruit-growing regions of the U.S. Usually, you know, the USDA will establish a quarantine if they know what's going on, but fruit flies are so common that there's no quarantine on fruit flies. And so no one knew that there was a different fruit fly. And so there wasn't any kind of regulation in place.
Now, Bill, on the cover of your journal, the IPM Practitioner, for October of 2015, when you did this big article, there's a very large photo of a creature that looks to me very reminiscent of a housefly. The difference being the wings are very translucent with two distinctive eye spots on the back of the wing. But now I'm thinking that I'm looking at a picture that's 100 times larger than this creature, right, in real life.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that the adults are like 1/16 of an inch. So they're sort of like gnats. What you can do is that you can set up monitoring traps. And this is the easiest one, is to take like a clear plastic cup and put apple cider vinegar in it, about 1 inch or 2 inches at the bottom of the cup. And then you cut out some holes around the top of the cup and then cover it. And so this attracts fruit flies in general, but mostly you will find that it is somewhat specific for this particular one. And so then you set that out, and then you check that from time to time, and that's the best way to monitor for them.
So we're putting out these little sippy cups, and we're checking them, and then when we start to get some hits, do we then put out much larger traps? I mean, because these creatures are too small to net out. Would floating row covers keep them?
Yeah, actually, you know, like if you're just dealing with backyard gardens, probably the best thing to do is to use netting, because that's the only thing that 100% works.
But it would have to be so fine.
Yeah, it's fine netting that you would use like for no-see-ums. like 1 millimeter grid.
Right.
So that's like 1/25th of an inch.
But you're also then excluding bees. I'm thinking of my...
Yeah, what you have to do is wait until the fruit is pollinated and is developing, and then you put the net on after it's been pollinated.
Right, because you don't have to worry about these creatures.
They won't bother it until it starts to get right.
Okay. And by then, I mean, there may be some flowers still forming, but it probably, you'll have to make the decision if you want to try to protect your fruit rather than get those last couple of flowers pollinated. So what do you think? Is this going to be yet another in a long line of pests that flies into our life, has a big effect right away, and then kind of levels out, or is this a new emerald ash borer?
I think that it will finally level out because one of the reasons it spread so quickly is that the biocontrols that we have haven't caught up to it yet. And so that there's some evidence that there are pupal parasitoids that are going to have some effect on it to cut the populations down. And also some of the predators, like some of the predatory bugs, will eat larvae.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think over a period of time that it will be less of a pest, but I think it once it gets established, it's going to stay. One of the reasons it's such a problem is that even in cold areas, that's the other thing we haven't mentioned, is that it thrives at about 70 degrees, and when it starts to get cold, it does poorly, and when it starts to get hot, it doesn't reproduce as quickly. So that in cold areas where you get down below freezing, that it has a real impact on the populations. So what they do is that they shelter in outbuildings and anywhere that they can find, and they overwinter as adults. But it kills most of the population, and so they develop very slowly. And in cold areas, they don't become a problem until about September. But in places like California and Oregon, which is sort of moderate throughout the year, that you got them year-round. The other thing is that they can go to alternate hosts. Like they have over 200 plants that they can utilize for food, including things like honeysuckles and all kinds of ornamentals and wild berries. And so they can just, once they overwinter, they can just hang out in the landscape, even on non-host things like evergreen trees, you know, like you say, just like mosquitoes, and sort of lurk and wait for the fruit to ripen, and then they go from one crop to another.
Now, Bill, you mentioned beneficial insects. So I would imagine that there are these tiny microscopic wasps that parasitize the eggs. Is that one?
Yeah, the pupal parasitoids. In other words, these things go through, metamorphosis, and so they spend some time as larvae, and then they go to pupae. And so the pupae are attacked by these wasps that are specialized in that particular life stage. This insect is so sophisticated that the larval parasitoids are killed by its immune system.
Oh, good Lord. I've never heard of such a thing.
I mean, it's a tough beast.
It really is. Bill, do these little wasps occur naturally, or are they going to have to be bred and released?
They will probably do what they call the classic biocontrol. They'll probably import some of these from Asia where it originated and release them.
And what would prey on the adult flies?
That's the thing, is the adult fly, you know, it's pretty mobile. And so it has to be a pretty quick bug to get it just as it is laying an egg. The other thing is that if you're trying to watch your fruit and everything, it's very secretive and it lays its eggs at night.
Oh, goodness.
It's sneaky. You do not want to give these guys any kind of food to overwinter with. You want to make sure that any drop fruit you pick up and any kind of infested fruit, you actually have to bury it or put it into a plastic bag and solarize it, or drop it into landfill in a closed bag. You can't compost it because the life cycle is so fast that it will develop before the heat develops in the compost pile to kill it.
And the compost pile itself could become a nice overwintering site.
Yeah, that could be a problem.
All right, Bill Quarles, thank you for alerting us. Keep us posted on the release of the parasites of these creatures. That sounds like a way to fight back. But home gardeners, small fruit growers, clean up your orchard floor. And we will tell you more about these vinegar traps. We'll link up with Bill's organization, which you can find online. It's a very easy address to remember. It's the letters BIRC for Biointegral Resource Center .org. Bill Quarles, director of the BIRC, editor of the IPM Practitioner, thanks so much for being on the show and bringing us more bad news, Bill.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care, man. And now, back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Fran, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Fran.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Fran. Where are you?
I am in Fairmount, Philadelphia.
Fairmount
neighborhood.
By the art museum, I'm going to suggest?
Yes.
Yes, it's a great section of Philly. That's leads you right down to the East River Drive, the Art Museum, the Parkway, one of the real nice parts of the city.
I enjoy it. Yes, I do.
All right. What can we do for Fran in Fairmount?
I have a small orchid plant that's in a 3 to 4 inch pot. It's typical of what is sold in the area that people can buy at a market or your local shop in the neighborhood. It has white flowers with a little yellow center. The problem is, I don't know what's wrong with the leaves. They wrinkle up, and now they're flopping over the plant edge. So the flowers look fine, but the leaves look like they're starved for water, and I keep watering it. I've moved it to every room, so I don't know if it's the light or the water, or maybe I don't have mulch on it, but the leaves themselves are just, you can see fine little wrinkles in the leaves, and everybody else's orchids that I've seen look fine and healthy at this time of year.
Yeah, but Fran, let's be honest here. You see somebody's got an orchid on their kitchen counter. You're not looking at the leaves, honey. You're looking at the flowers. They may have pretty leaves, but if they got no flowers, they feel inferior to you. So
That's true.
You are ahead of the game, so what? So I'm probably going to suggest that you have what's called the basic phalaenopsis or moth orchid. These are so-called because you get a couple of long sticks coming up from the base of the plant, and along the sticks are various buds that open at different times. And if you get like 4 or 5 buds open in a row, it really does look like a series of butterflies or tropical moths in flight.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, and you say you've moved it to every kind of light, right?
Right. I now have it under my fluorescent tube lighting in the laundry room.
Okay, that is probably not necessary, but how far away are the leaves from the lights?
Probably about 1.5 feet.
Yeah. So to be honest, the lumens drop off from fluorescent lights after an inch or two. So you're probably not harming it. One of the biggest enemies of phalaenopsis is bright light. See, in the wild, most orchids, including this type of orchid, are epiphytes. They grow up in the canopy of the rainforest. Their roots wrap around trees, but they don't go into the trees. They don't take any nutrients from the trees. That's the difference between an epiphyte and a parasite. An epiphyte is just hanging on. A parasite is actually sucking the juice out of you. So these things are just wrapped around trees, and what they get is filtered light through the canopy of the trees. They're not up there in the blinding sunlight. And because the rainforest is moist and it kind of rains 2 or 3 times a day, they get these gentle rains coming down, but they never get saturated because their roots are literally in the open. I mean, forget any kind of bark or any kind of mulch. They're just kind of wrapped around the tree, hanging on the tree. So in the little pot that you have, what's in it around the roots of the orchid?
I'm not sure. There's nothing on the top. It's in a plastic cup inside of the pot.
And how have you been watering it?
I've been dousing it once a week until water runs through it.
And then you put it back?
Right.
And have you had it in really bright light?
It's not in direct light. It's southern light in one room and northern light in the other room. I have it in the windowsill.
Oh, okay. No. Get it out of the windowsill. Get it away from the southern light. You know, these orchids can actually do fine just sitting down on like a kitchen counter, just in enough ambient light for us to read a newspaper by.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, unless you're living in a $8 million mansion in Fairmount, those windows are getting cold at night in the winter.
Mm.
You want to keep this plant nice and warm. It likes to stay toasty. It likes ambient light. There's nothing wrong with your watering schedule, but keep it out of windowsills. Put it in the center of the room as if it was a silk flower, and I think the leaves will perk up. And don't expose it to really bright light.
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck, Fran.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. You take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that the famed Philadelphia Flower Show will be held March 5th through the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philly. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.com just yet, because we'll be right back with the secrets of superlative seed starting and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural gardening products and solutions. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will get you ready for this season's successful seed starting. We'll go over all the basics, and we'll add a little bit on a topic that we haven't done a lot on, which is how to feed the baby plants when they're big enough to get fed, but before they're old enough to go out in the garden. That's all coming up right after this.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by Burpee, celebrating 140 years of introducing unique new varieties and providing treasured heirlooms, hardworking hybrids, live plants, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. More at burpee.com. And by Harvest Right. Harvest Right's home freeze dryer allows you to preserve your own freeze-dried food that can last 25 years. Meat, fruit, vegetables, and ice cream can be freeze-dried at home. More at harvestright.com.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey there, Mike. This is David in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I had a question for you about my former azalea bush.
Oh, okay.
This summer, I sold my house to my father-in-law, who is living there now. And so in the winter, every time it would snow, before I would get out and clear the driveway or do anything else, I would go and knock the snow off of my azalea bush so that the limbs wouldn't break from the heavy weight of the snow. I am fairly certain that I am not going to get him to do that on the different snowstorms that come in throughout the winter. So I didn't know if there was anything I could do or if I even really needed to be worried about that.
I don't think you need to be worried about it. Indianapolis is a lot like the area I live in terms of snowfall and the types of snow. We've had some brutal ones. Nothing was ever going to be worse than the Halloween snowstorm we had when we got 12 inches of wet snow with the leaves still on the trees several years back. I mean, that, boy, that got a lot more sunlight on my garden. The woods got thinned out really nice. But it didn't hurt my azaleas or rhododendrons. Azaleas have a kind of, if you look at them, the habit they have is they look nice and full when they're in flower. But if you look at them in the wintertime, you realize there's a lot of room in between those branches for snow to drop down. And a lot of times, if people go out there whacking their plants with brooms and stuff, they can do more damage than good.
Question two for you on the bush.
Go ahead.
So the nice thing about selling the house to my father-in-law is I'm going to get to come and take all of my bushes and perennials and all the things that he could care less about.
Right.
Most of the things are fairly small. The azalea bush is probably 15 to 20 years old.
Excellent.
What are the odds that I successfully get it out of the ground without killing it?
Well, as long as you are aware that the roots are very fragile, you got to go into it knowing that. What you're going to do is you're going to let it flower at his house.
Okay.
When all the flowers are done, then you're going to trim it back by a third. And then you're going to get a bunch of guys with shovels who are going to start way on the outskirts of the plant. And what you want to do is get those shovels down deep in the ground. You're not trying to get the plant out of the ground. You're trying to get like a floating city with the roots as intact as possible because they're very sensitive, delicate roots. This is not something you want to do a lot of root pruning on. So then once you got the island out of the ground, you would put that island of dirt on a tarp, kind of pull the tarp up around the plant, and then take it to its new home, protected from the wind, like not in the back of an open pickup truck.
Okay.
You see these plants being carried around in the open backs of open pickup trucks in high winds. They're not long for the world. The other thing you can do, if you want, is, again, right after the flowers fade in the spring, is you can take cuttings and try to root them.
I'm guessing I can find instructions on the Gardens Alive website.
Yeah,
how to do that?
Yes, under plant propagation. There's also very good articles about it online. You know, essentially what you're doing is you're taking real nice new green growth from the spring, and you have a big pot full of a nice soil-free mix. You're gently putting those cuttings in there. You're keeping that mix moist, and then you're surrounding it in a humidity tent, kind of like a giant plastic bag, keeping it out of the sun, and then you're just keeping that mix moist. And then if you begin to see new growth, on some of the sticks that are in there. Then you can lighten up on the tent, back off a little bit on the watering, and with any luck, by the end of the season, you'll have new rooted plants.
That could be a good backup plan in case I do a lot of damage when I move it also.
You got to prune it anyway, so there's absolutely no reason not to do both.
Okay, great.
All right, dude?
All right, have a great day.
All right, good luck, sir.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Linda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hi.
Hello, Linda. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Where is Linda doing well?
Kimberton, Pennsylvania.
All right. What can we do for you, Linda?
Well, every year I go to this great herb sale in Chester Springs, and I quickly learned where all the smart little old ladies were running to get the salvias. Over the years, I always buy 2, 3, 5, 6 tropical salvias, so I have color at the end of the summer, and they're exotic and really fun. Anyway, this year, it took the whole summer from May till the fall to blossom. Then we had an early frost, so I only had flowers for 2 weeks. So I decided to dig some up and bring them in. And I've never done that except with amaryllis. And I put them in the basement, and I put them by, I have, you know, windows narrow, and they started sprouting. And so I've moved them away from the light. I've called around. Nobody knows if I should keep them dark or light. I do water them lightly and love them well. But I'm not sure if I don't have a greenhouse and my garage is too cold, I think.
Well, so, you got a greenhouse.
I guess
got,
I do.
You got a greenhouse in your basement, Lynn. Come on. Okay.
Built-in greenhouse.
Okay, so here's the deal. Salvia is another name for sage. All sages are salvias. All salvias are sages. Many sages slash salvias are winter hardy. You can leave them out in the garden and they'll come back year after year. But you're sure that the ones you're growing, and this is a huge family of plants, are frost sensitive.
We had one extremely warm winter, and one came back. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they don't come back.
Now, do they have scented leaves?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the one that became very leggy in the basement, I cut it, and I felt like it was spring. Beautiful scent.
So here's the deal. Like pepper plants, salvias are perennial if they're protected from frost. So what I'm going to suggest you do is, in the future, I think you should grow these things in containers. Take them out in the spring. Give them your absolute best light. Make sure they get the most sunlight they can.
You know, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, keep them watered. The more sunlight you get, the sooner you're going to get those flowers. And then you'll attract bees and butterflies and hummingbirds. And as soon as the weather starts to get cool, bring them back down to that basement, which sounds like it's perfectly warm enough. And what I'm going to suggest you do is go out to a home store and buy a fluorescent light fixture, a shop light, essentially. 4-foot-long tubes, though. 4-foot-long fluorescent tubes. The fixture can hold 2 of them or 4 of them. But you hang it on top of a table, and then you put your plants, your salvias, in their pots underneath this fluorescent fixture as close to the bulbs as you can get them, and they'll continue to flower for you all winter long indoors. You can cut them and bring the cut flowers upstairs. At the very least, you'll have huge live plants to take out into your garden the following year. These things will turn into small trees over time.
I know. I have a girlfriend who's, she's moved away, but she had a huge bush, beautiful bush.
And that's really all you got to do. Get them outside in the summertime, bring them inside in the winter, and fluorescent light is very inexpensive. It's very effective. Anytime you feel like you need cheering up, just go down and look at all these beautiful plants in flower.
Okay. Wow. Well, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. You enjoy your salvias.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Basic seed starting and baby plant feeding. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started with this week's question, please.
Sure, Mike. Tyler in Harleysville, PA writes, I'll be starting basil and tomatoes under some LED fixtures that I can adjust to keep the lights just above the plants. I'll use a timer to provide the appropriate amount of light each day, which I still need to research. My question is about feeding. I've heard you say that potting soil has almost no nutrients. So how should I feed my young plants? Once they're outside, I'll use my own compost made from fall leaves, but I don't want to use it inside the house. Is there some kind of granular feed you would recommend?
Well, we have to start by thanking Tyler for his timeliness here. This is the perfect time of year to deliver a little primer on seed starting. And I'll begin by suggesting that those lights be left on for 16 hours a day, and then give the baby plants 8 hours of darkness every cycle.
Mike, what do you think of his use of LEDs?
Well, they're clearly the next big thing in indoor growing, but I just don't know a lot about them. And besides, I already have several sets of 4-foot-long fluorescent tube fixtures that work really well for me. But the basic principle is always going to be the same. You want to keep the baby plants very close to your lights to ensure that they get enough lumens. And that means you need lights that don't get too hot. Those old-school incandescent bulbs would just cook baby plants.
When I was little, I cooked with a 60-watt incandescent bulb in my Easy-Bake oven.
Right. Great for baby cupcakes, bad for baby tomatoes. Now, timing. Start your seeds 2 months before you intend to put the plants in the ground. So if you typically plan on May 1st, your start date is March 1st. May 15th equals March 15th. And if you live in a really cooler clime, plant on April Fool's Day for June 1st in the garden, so you don't get fooled by a late frost.
And Tyler already seems to know not to use garden soil to start his seeds.
It's just the worst. Using a light, loose, soil-free mix allows for the maximum root growth and good drainage that produces healthy plants. And beginning the season with healthy, vigorous starts gives you your best shot at long-term success. Trying to sprout your seeds in clay soil in the infamous sunny windowsill always delivers weak, puny, leggy plants. You got 2 strikes on you before you even get out in the garden.
And you advise people to use the same kinds of plastic six-packs that nurseries use, because they're designed to hold moisture but also drain well. And they provide the kind of depth that allows plants to develop deep roots.
Right. No egg cartons, people. Now fill those correct containers with your light, loose, soil-free mix and sit them in water for a few hours until the mix can become totally saturated. You may have to put a dish or something on top of them to hold them down in the water in the beginning. Then sow 2 seeds on top of this wet medium in each cell, cover them with a little more mix, cover the containers with something like saran wrap to retain moisture, and put them in a warm but not a hot spot. If you're planning on doing this every season, heating mats are a great investment. They'll get your seeds sprouted quickly without ever cooking them.
Place your freshly sown containers in a low tray that holds water and add water when the tray gets dry. Then check them every day. Take the wrapping off as soon as you see the very first sprouts. Immediately stop using any bottom heat and get your plants under bright light with no more than an inch between the lights and your baby plants.
And don't worry about all those seeds that haven't sprouted yet. Any viable ones are going to be popping up real soon. keep those uncovered plants close to your lights, and now start cutting back on the water.
Okay, so when and how do we feed?
Well, the nice thing about high-quality bagged organic potting and seed-starting soils is that most of them already contain small amounts of natural nutrients like worm castings and compost, and they feed the baby plants perfectly for those first couple of weeks. And you know, seeds also contain a lot of their own starter food, so don't add anything until the plants are a few inches high and have multiple leaves. It's going to be about 3 or 4 weeks after germination.
Then what?
Then first we snip away. This is the hardest chore emotionally, but it has to be done. Use a small pair of scissors to snip off the weakest looking sprouts until you only have one plant left per cell. Choose the shortest, stockiest specimens for survival, and be sure to snip those others off. Don't yank them out. Then get a bag of high-quality compost or worm castings and make tea to feed your plants. Fill an old sock with the compost or castings, let it sit in a quart of water for a few hours, and then use that tea to water and feed your plants from then on. You can switch to your homemade compost or a balanced organic fertilizer after the young plants have been outsettled in the garden for a couple of weeks. Well, that was a nice short course on starting your own plants from seed now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to previous articles that go into lots more details about each of those subjects, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. And that's it. We are out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, especially if you're certain we don't need to know that. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live. And where you will probably find the answers to those garden questions you were going to email us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Thanks to our special guest today, Dr. Bill Quarles of the Biointegral Resource Center. To learn more about the BIRC and their fine publications, visit BIRC.org. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Lauren Elkins keep our website brightly lit. Light and Loose Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Well-fed Al Banks is our editor. Off to a great start is our new production assistant, Eileen Keller. I'm overfed and underlit Mike McGrath, but I'll buy myself a new set of bulbs and cut back a little on the castings so I can see you again next week. Composting your food scraps is good for the planet, but fruit flies are bad for your BP. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal an easy way to keep airborne annoyances out of your kitchen waste and worm bin, plus your fabulous phone calls.